Welcome to the Smoke and Rope Podcast, the show that brings together Michigan's top cannabis growers, advocates, and business owners to offer a fresh and honest perspective of Michigan's cannabis industry. Stick with us to get the lowdown from the people who have been on the ground floor of cannabis business in Michigan and gain insights into where the industry may be heading.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Smoke and Rope Podcast. I'm Ryan Baser, your host, and very excited today to have a national guest, national expert, Aaron Smith. He's the co-founder and the CEO of the National Cannabis Industry Association. Thank you for being on the show, Aaron. We're really happy you joined.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right. Thank you. We have, as always, Tom Beller over at Real Leaf Solutions, way up north in Kalkaska. Tom, how you doing? And have the leaves started changing yet?
Oh, yeah. We're about to pop into full color if the rain doesn't take it all down before. Right. So if you're looking for it, you got better come up soon.
All right. Well, we'll see you in about another weekend. Kevin over at True Cannabis in Lansing. Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
Great, Ryan. How you doing, buddy?
Doing good. All right. Well, I'm excited to introduce Aaron, and you know, obviously he's the first guest that we haven't focused on Michigan, but with the election coming up, what's going on with marijuana legalization, and just so my good friend Mark Passerini reached out to Aaron, and I know they've known each other a while, so I just wanted to give a little background on that, and then let Aaron tell us all about himself and what's going on. So when I was 18, I was out selling books door to door in San Francisco, and I met Mark Passerini. There's a couple other marijuana people out there as well, Troy Dayton, Shay Gunther, and I became lifelong friends with Mark. And in 2010, he helped me open up Capital City Caregivers in Lansing, and then I turned around a couple months later and helped him open Oma Medicine. Then I had my federal raids and indictments, and at that time, Mark started getting heavily involved in ArcView and the NCIA, and we just took different trajectories. And I was able to come back, and in 2019, I was able to leave the state and you know, off of everything. And I got to go to Lobby Days. That's where I met Aaron, and it was awesome to see what he's done in 10 years. And you look at the pictures that everyone's seen them on the steps of the Capitol. And from the first year, how many people were there to the 2019, it was amazing. Aaron is the expert really in the world on U.S. Marijuana policy and legalization. So with that, you know, Aaron, thanks for being on the show. Please tell us about yourself, how you got there, and what's going on.
Yeah. Thanks for that introduction, Ryan. Yeah, it sure has been a wild ride, hasn't it, over the last 10 years in cannabis. NCIA is going strong, even in the midst of a economic collapse and public health crisis and everything else that this country is facing. Cannabis is still an issue that is really, you know, resonating in the halls of Congress. And you know, as we've been moving the dial, you know, kind of it seems incremental and almost painfully slow, as you know, as we're many years into this movement, much longer than NCIA's existence, and we're still working on federal legalization. But I'm really hopeful that we're getting there soon, as this has become a almost non-controversial issue.
Well, that's that's wonderful to hear. I had a question for you as before we get into some more of the issues. Before you went to and founded the NCIA, you were the director, I believe, MPP, the California director in policy. What was that like? And did you work with Peter Lewis at that time? And then, like, what made you decide to go out on your own?
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, that was sort of my first professional foray into cannabis reform. And before that, I was, an advocate. I was actually arrested for cannabis as a teenager and treated pretty badly by the police and turned me into a lifelong activist. And I did find MPP in 2005. You know, I think at a normal conference, I met the MPP's director at the time. I met Peter Lewis a couple of times, but we never really worked directly. But he, you know, he funded, I think, you know, I think maybe half of the organization at that time. When I started working for MPP, we were in California just trying to get the majority of getting all of the counties and cities within this, you know, the giant nation state of California to obey Proposition 215, which had been passed, you know, had been in law for almost 10 years at that point. Yet, you know, California is a very diverse state, and there are places, especially in the rural parts, that we're essentially just saying, well, this is violation of federal law, so we're going to ignore this law. Our county didn't vote for it, so we're going to ignore it. We're going to keep arresting patients. We're not going to allow dispensaries. We're going to not implement the at the time there was a ID card program that would protect patients from arrest that many of these counties were not implementing. So it was my job to go into these rural counties, usually rural, and organize patients, get them out to the county board of supervisors meetings, and, you know, get them to, you know, really put political pressure on, you know, on the local officials to, at the very least, comply with the state law. And it was pretty eye-opening. You know, I honestly got into this kind of as a, you know, I when I first got into this, I didn't know too much about medical cannabis. I you know, I knew it was real and it was on the books as a law in California. But, you know, I was more of a drug legalizer, I guess, that, you know, thought that medical cannabis was a kind of a tactic to get us to adult use. Mm-hmm. But in that experience, I met so many patients up and down the state, and you know, it really was in some, you know, heart-wrenching sometimes to because I was trying to get these people that were having a hard time getting out of bed in the morning because of pain or other, you know, health problems, and I was trying to get them to come out and advocate for themselves and in a sometimes hostile environments, and it really, you know, turned me into a true believer.
Man, oh, that's you know, like everyone on the show here today, we've been in cannabis for at least 10 to 15 years, depending on it. And then I didn't, you know, that's it takes that. And you were a trendsetter and a pioneer early on and doing what nobody has done. And that's fascinating. You know, there's something we've had, like, State Senator Jeff Irwin and different people on our show recently and asking consultants we've asked, you know, the questions like Safe Banking Act and legalization and the election federally, but now we have you on. So I'd love to hear, you know, when lobby days in 19, we were talking a lot about the Safe Banking Act, obviously not going to make it through the Senate. What's going on with that right now?
Yeah, so, you know, I started this year off really optimistic that Safe Banking would make it through the Senate and likely be signed by the president. It passed the House with a really resounding bipartisan majority at the end of 2019. And, you know, anything bipartisan these days is very rare, very, very rare. So I was feeling really good as Safe Banking went over onto the Senate side. It's currently sitting in the Senate Banking Committee, which is, you know, chaired by Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho. Not a fan of cannabis, and he represents one of the you know, three states that doesn't have a cannabis law on the books. But you know, he's even open to the idea, you know, of moving the bill. There, you know, he had some questions about and some proposed amendments to the bill to make it stricter. Only one of them I considered a poison pill, which was trying to somehow restrict potency. So, you know, you couldn't get a bank account unless your cannabis products were under a certain potency threshold, which is kind of absurd on a lot of levels. You know, like the banks are gonna somehow monitor potency. We've been having conversations with his office and others, and pretty hopeful that this was gonna move. Although COVID hit in March, and at that point, for obvious reasons, the whole mood of Congress around cannabis and any issue that wasn't immediately directly related to fixing the economic or health problems that were you know related to this pandemic was really put on hold. With that said, we kind of reframed the conversation around safe banking and started, you know, really talking about this as, you know, because carrying a lot of cash around is a public health problem, right? And so safe banking is included in the HEROES Act, which is the latest bill passed by the House. It was included back when they first passed it in May. And then, you know, the Senate did nothing as they do. They kind of just did nothing on this issue at all for months and months. And then now came back and there have been some negotiations between the House and the Senate. The Senate has now passed a second version of the HEROES Act as of yesterday or day before yesterday. And that version is kind of a scaled down. It doesn't have as much, you know, spending for COVID relief, but notably does include the safe banking language. And, you know, the Senate's going to pass its version of the bill. I don't think the Senate version will include safe banking. I would be really surprised if it did. But at the end of the day, the two bodies are going to have to come together, hammer out the differences in conference committee. And I think, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic that this could be included in the final bill. If not this one, the next one. There will be more COVID relief bills coming, I suspect. Unfortunately, this economic downturn is going to be a while. But I think it really bodes well that this was included in that bill because, you know, that's a must-pass bill. And for cannabis to be included in any bill like that is, I mean, we've really come a long way to see that.
Hey, Aaron, this is Kevin Pybus with True Cannabis. I met you back in 2016. We've been members of the NCIA for going on 4 years now. I met you outside the regional convention you guys had there in Chicago, and it actually ended up being the same meeting that I ended up meeting Mark Passerini. And so I feel that it's been noteworthy that the extent of networking in this industry is just incredible. Ryan's story about me and Mark out in California selling books door to door. I mean, it's just crazy how the world turns. But, you know, I know you've been the director over there for the last 10 years. You know, one of the most important things I think that has come out over the last 10 years is the Cole memo. That has protected us. And we appreciate you working hard on that and the Safe Banking Act. You know, one of my questions was with the Safe Banking Act, does that also include tax relief for dispensaries as well?
Hey, well, first of all, thank you for the membership and the memory of meeting in Chicago. We've come a long way, and it seems like Mark Passerini's at the center of it all. I love it. He's a great guy. you know, the Safe Banking Act is actually really narrowly tailored and does not include any tax relief or anything like that. It essentially just provides protections. It provides legal protections to banks that want to do business with the industry, and that's why it enjoys the large bipartisan support. And you know, the way things work in Congress is, you know, they're very timid creatures over there. And, you know, this will, if and, well, not, it's not if, but when safe banking passes, it will be most likely the very first positive cannabis reform bill to ever pass out of Congress, ever in the history of the country. And, or at least since Prohibition. And once that happens, I think that will kind of open up the eyes of members of Congress. They'll understand that, okay, well, there was really no political blowback for that. They'll get reelected and be able to move on to bigger issues like tax, you know, tax relief and, you know, ending the unfair provision of 280E. And more important than that, just descheduling cannabis altogether, beginning to regulate it in a way that's more appropriate for a substance that's so much safer than alcohol or even over-the-counter drugs. That, you know, once that happens, that'll fix 280E and many of the other problems that the industry faces.
Yeah, I can't agree more. How do you think the states that did stay open during the pandemic that were deemed essential, how do you think that's going to affect things moving forward? Do you think that'll give us some momentum there as well?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a really good point. I think it has already. I mean, the lesson learned here is that the, you know, an industry that was kind of thought of as a pariah just, you know, a few years or months ago before the pandemic, was almost universally considered essential, while other businesses were forced to close down. And that, you know, I mean, cannabis is essential. It's a, it's an essential, medicine for so many, and also an alternative to alcohol. And, but from an economic perspective, you know, that I think that it's important that we as an industry make sure that the governors and the states and the and lawmakers, not just governors, lawmakers in general, remember that we were essential and that we, our employees are on the front lines during this pandemic while others were home and unemployed. And that meant that our industry was also, you know, continuing to create jobs and keep people out of the unemployment lines when, you know, during this so difficult time. And I do think that it's certainly a sign of the times of the, you know, the appetite politically that has changed around cannabis, in that that we are essential everywhere but Massachusetts, I believe, we were open and operating.
And hey, Aaron, that's we're recording this on Wednesday, and last night was the, you know, the debate, and it's probably fresh and a lot of people's minds. And what's your take on what happens if Trump gets elected, or Biden, and then the makeup obviously of the Senate? Is there a chance there to for the Dems to take that? What's you know, what do you think about all that?
Yeah, I mean, as far as cannabis is concerned, I think probably what's most important in terms of, you know, all those things you mentioned is this, the Senate, the makeup of the Senate. I think moving the Senate from a Republican to a Democratic majority is, I run a nonpartisan organization that works on both sides of the aisle, right? And, you know, we work with Republicans and Democrats alike. But I would be remiss to not say that I think shifting the majority in the Senate from the Republicans to the Democrats would probably be the single best thing that could ever happen to cannabis right now. We, you know, safe banking is an example. When you look at that issue, I am confident. I would put a, you know, a lot of money on the fact that if the Senate had a vote on the Safe Banking Act, it would pass. It would pass with the 60 plus majority that it needs to get to the president's desk. But as long as Mitch McConnell is there, it's almost no bill is getting passed out of the House, right? Any bill that comes from the House basically gets shot down because it's the partisan rancor, and there's a dysfunction in government. But you know, I think making that shift would would be huge, and we would have a bill onto the president's desk. In terms of, you know, Trump or Biden, I from a personal level, I think that in some ways the fate of our republic hinges on this, and that, you know, I think we have to get Trump out of the White House for many reasons. But from a cannabis standpoint, I think almost either of them is I'm almost indifferent. although that, you know, because I think Trump is not, neither one of them are huge advocates for this issue. But, you know, Trump hasn't done anything kind of good, bad, or indifferent on the issue. It's just kind of allowed cannabis to, you know, to thrive. With that said, you know, I think clearly having the kind of partisan rancor we have right now, I think that legislation favorable to our issue is more likely to pass if we have Democrats in, you know, both the House or the House, Senate, and the White House, because I would have concerns that if Democrats took the Senate, passed legislation, and got it on to a President Trump desk, he would veto it because he's not going to sign any Democratic bill. Okay. You know, and Biden has made statements about rescheduling, which are of concern. I think rescheduling cannabis is actually would cause more problems for the industry than we currently have. But the good news is you know, Senator Harris, who's, you know, of course, the VP nominee, is the chief proponent of the MORE Act, which is, you know, a great piece of legislation that would deschedule. So, you know, I think there's a lot of optimism to be had there.
Yeah, get out and vote. You know, people know your issues and know where the people stand, and, you know, vote out the opposition. Hey, Aaron, Tom Beller with Real Leaf. We are a Class C grow located in Northern Michigan. Currently not members of the NCIA, but you know, that's definitely something that we have on our list of things to be taking a look at here in the very near future. We are members of the Michigan Cannabis Industry Association, which is one of the, I believe, Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, two major associations as far as the regulated market is concerned in Michigan.
Yeah, there's two. Yep.
Okay, so the MICIA is more of the grassroots. They've been advocates from the beginning. MMFLA, even prior to that. Just looking at that versus there's another group that has more of a larger corporate type structure as far as who they allow into their association. The MICIA has more of the mom and pop companies that are, you know, that they're representing. At the national level, how does that compare to the way you've seen it? You guys have been around for 10 years. You formed the NCIA 10 years ago, and you've had way more experience in states that have paved the way with the cannabis industry. How does that compare? Are you seeing a lot of this big dog versus little dog in other states? What is the trend? So, you know, for some of these smaller businesses to feel like they still can maintain a foothold while larger interests come into the market.
Yeah, I mean, that's a trend we see play out in state after state. You know, we're a big fan of really big being a big tent in terms of as an organization representing big businesses, medium businesses, and the small mom and pops. But ultimately, especially at the state level, you do see interests diverge. And, you know, the larger companies end up having different interests. And, you know, I think that it's kind of a shame considering, you know, we're still, you know, just trying to create this industry, and you're already getting kind of protectionism and this sort of thing happening with the larger businesses trying to drive out the smaller ones. But it is kind of, you know, just part of capitalism, I guess. And it's, you see it play out across every industry. And, you know, I do want to, you know, urge, you know, whoever's, you know, listening, whether, you know, if you're in the cannabis industry at all, it is really important that we work together as a whole to advance the whole industry, because there's room for everyone. You know, I look at beer as sort of probably our future. Something's going to look kind of like the beer or the wine industry. And, you know, sure, the beer industry, 2/3 of the beer industry is in the hands of a couple of companies. But there's still a huge thriving market in craft beer, hundreds and hundreds of craft brew, or thousands of craft breweries now at this point across the country. There's some great ones there in Michigan. And, you know, there's still plenty of opportunity for everyone. And so I think that, you know, when I see fractionalization of the industry in the states, and it's even happening a bit at the federal level, you have, you know, lobbying firms that say, well, we want to start our own association because they'll make a good client, you know. And that's just not the way, that's not the way this should be. But that's, it happens. And definitely think that the smarter operators out there understand that they should be part of probably, you know, a larger business is probably going to be, should, if they're smart, should be part of multiple trade associations. The ones that represent the, you know, the big boys, as well as the broader big tent organizations like Michigan CIA and NCIA. Because they then have a, you know, they have a say in what both are doing. And that's really what, you know, I'm seeing the smarter guys are doing.
Yeah. I have another follow up to then that, Aaron. This is Ryan again, and this is kind of new stuff in Michigan right now. Tomorrow, tonight at midnight, the caregiver supply is cut off completely in the regulated market, and we've been wondering what's going to happen to caregivers and the gray market here, and what that looks like. There's been no enforcement because of that, we're told. And you know, this other association, we're all big fans of the MICA. The other association is made up of like six companies that are all funded by the REIT out of San Diego, the industrial property. It's on the stock market. And you know, there's talk of them trying to change our act, raise the taxes, and put it at our excise tax, raise the percentage points, and give that money
to the black market enforcement division to go after, you know, caregivers and things like that. So we're battling that right now. And I know that's got to be a game plan for people in other states as far as trying to help the police and the government take out their competition. What are you seeing in other states? What's already happened with that? Obviously, you've seen California, Washington, Oregon, and Colorado.
Yeah, I mean, this is unfortunately, this is part of, you know, what we're seeing as the industry matures. I think, you know, it is important that we undercut the gray market, but that doesn't mean that we, you know, need to drive out, you know, we should do that by bringing the gray market operators into the light. And, you know, frankly, this is something that no state has really done very well, in my opinion. You know, we're seeing, you know, California, you mentioned, I mean, that's, you know, there's a place that has, you know, the underground market is thriving. And, you know, because they've put, you know, taxes in place and, you know, hurdles to jump through that are, you know, nearly impossible for somebody who's, you know, just growing 1 acre or less of cannabis. And so, but what that means is we end up betraying, in my opinion, the will of the voters, because the voters who pass these laws in across the country, when we look at polling and, you know, when you talk to voters, they're doing it because, not so much because they like cannabis, they're doing it because they're looking to eliminate the criminal element from cannabis, because they know that the biggest problem associated with cannabis is prohibition and the criminal element. And when we don't institute laws that ensure that those who are in the criminal side of it can enter the legal market, we will always have an underground market. And so I think that without knowing the details of the, you know, the Michigan statute, you know, I think obviously you guys all know Robin Schneider would be and those at MICIA would be the folks that really know the details there. But in big, broad strokes, that's sort of my take on it, is there has to be a way to allow caregivers and individual small producers to enter the legal system.
Hey, Aaron, this is Kevin Pybus again with True Cannabis. This kind of ties in slightly, but a little bit off topic, but making news in Michigan also is the potential opening of a dispensary and cultivation on an Indian reservation here in Upper Michigan. I think they've done that in other states as well. Just wondering what the federal take is on that. Some of them are not even intending on getting state licensed, and I'm not sure, you know, what their game plan is, but what is the federal government talking about?
Well, I mean, right now the federal government is in a standstill, and the only thing we've seen move really is safe banking. But there definitely is conversations around that happening, especially in places, you know, like Oklahoma, that has, you know, where most of the land is native sovereign land. But, you know, these are sovereign tribes, and I think that they, it's, you know, it's pretty tricky because they're competing with state regulated businesses, but at the end of the day, and you know, this is my personal opinion, these are sovereign tribes that should be able to set their own laws that are completely completely independent from the state and from the federal government, in that matter. And I think that there's gonna be a lot of, you know, negotiation with, especially within the state, to make sure that, you know, that the two systems can coexist. And you know, we're seeing this movement kind of really slowly in terms of, like I said, at the federal government, where, you know, there's just prohibition across the board, and you know, that's kind of made it so that they can kind of bury their heads in the sand. But I think, you know, long term, it's going to be similar to what we see, like I said, with alcohol or other things, where you have multiple systems, including those that are enacted by tribes, that you know, I mean, you have places, you have tribal lands that are completely dry in some parts of the country, right? Where alcohol is not even allowed to, you know, you can't even possess alcohol. And then you're going to see other places that aren't like that. And I think that, you know, the two systems have to exist side by side, and there's still plenty of room to compete and have, you know, thriving markets. And, you know, even if you have these sorts of regulations that vary widely.
Hey, Aaron, I want, you know, we haven't talked much about it yet, and love to hear about, as far as the NCIA, what you think a real timeline is on doing some events back where there is public, if you have any idea. And then what are you guys doing in the meantime? Because I think everybody that's listening should join just for the lobbying that you guys do. I've seen it firsthand. It's pretty powerful. But besides that, what's going on the rest of the NCAA front?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking that. And do hope everybody does join NCIA. If you're in the cannabis industry and you're not part of the association, then, you know, there's others out there that are shouldering this burden for you. And the faster we can get to legalization, or the more members that NCIA has, the faster we will get to legalization. And in terms of our events, you know, we clearly in the middle of a pandemic, we're not doing in-person events. We had initially moved all of our lobby days, our big national conference, and, you know, back in March, we initially moved them into the fall time period, into September, October, November. Fast forward 6 months, and gosh, March seemed like 10 years ago. And we have now, you know, of course, decided we can't do events at all this year. In person. So all of our events are taking place online. We have Cannabis Caucus events, which are regional focused events happening throughout actually this month, that are open to members only. We have, I believe we already did our Michigan one, but we have others happening this week. We have webinars on various topics that are being hosted either by staff or members of our committees on a, you know, couple a day actually. Or I'm sorry, a couple a week. Those are all free for members. Some of them are only for members. And then there's a, you know, really nominal fee for non-members to attend. And then I'm really excited about our Cannabis Business Summit cyber event coming up at the end or middle of November, just after the election, November 10th through 12th. This is going to be a big post-election conference with hundreds of speakers talking about, you know, best practices, policy developments that are happening from across the country, as well as a few keynotes, including Andrew Yang, who's keynoting on our second day, really to talk about the, you know, his experience in the kind of the intersection of entrepreneurialism and politics, and also kind of his take on, you know, where the cannabis industry fits into all of that. So anybody that's also available for free to our members, and then there's a nominal $50 to $150 fee for non-members, and anybody can find that information at the cannabisbusinesssummit.com. In terms of in-person events, we're monitoring the situation. The only in-person event that at this point, I don't even want to see guarantee, but the only one that we are currently promoting as an in-person event, or the only two that we're promoting as in-person events happening next year are Lobby Days, happening in mid-May in Washington, D.C., and then our Cannabis Business Summit in August in San Francisco. If, you know, depending on how a vaccine comes together and what, you know, what things look like, we hopefully will be doing more in-person events in the spring of 2021. But we're not going to do any in-person events until we know it's safe for our attendees and it makes sense to do so.
Yeah, that kind of ties in here. I know that the NCIA hosts your own weekly podcast. Is that correct?
Yeah, we just launched a second one. So we actually have two podcasts. We have the one that we've had for the longest is the NCIA's Cannabis Industry Voice with Bethany Moore. And then we just launched a few weeks ago the Cannabis Diversity Report with our DEI manager, Tahir Johnson. We already had a huge digital footprint, I would say, before the pandemic. But, you know, now it's sort of, you know, we've really expanded and would love to, have you guys on one of our podcasts one of these days.
We'd love that.
That'd be great. You have any advice for a fledgling podcast like this and some good guest ideas, send them our way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I admittedly am not the most web savvy person. I'm I'm in mid-40s now, I guess, but I would love to connect you with my savvier staff that have been leading our digital the digital real estate that we've been occupying lately.
That'd be great, Aaron. Well, what we usually do here, we're running out of time and we've got some hard deadlines, but we'd like to, just give some parting final thoughts or thank you. If anyone would like, I'll ask Tom and Kevin, and then love to hear from you as far as what you want to say to the listeners, and we already know why we should join the NCAA, but Kevin, what do you have any final thoughts before we take off here?
Yeah, I just want to thank you, Aaron, for all your hard work over the years. Having people like you moving the progress forward is very important in this whole thing. I know that we could have sat back and been happy that we got things done in our state, but you kept trudging forward and you've made a lot of progress. A lot of people sit back and say somebody should do something, and you're doing something, and it's very commendable and very appreciated. So I just want to say thank you.
All right. Kevin said it very eloquently there. But yeah, thank you. And also keep an eye out because Real Leaf will be joining on to the NCAA as soon as we possibly can. Cheers.
And then Aaron, this is Ryan here. Any final thoughts or message to... we're pretty much an industry podcast. It's almost all people that are in the business. So, obviously they should join, but, love to hear it one more time from you.
Well, yeah. Well, thank you guys for this opportunity and so much for the kind words there, and your support. You know, Michigan is a really special state to me personally, but I think to the industry. Has been, being the first Midwest state to move forward with adult use, and at least at the time, it was the second largest state to move forward with adult use. I think it's been a linchpin in the region, in the country, and we with the help of the Michigan industry and the whole, broadly the national industry, we will get to the day where cannabis is descheduled and. States are allowed to create their own systems to regulate without interference. It's just a matter of time, and it's also a matter of how it looks. What do federal regulations look like? There are a lot of different ideas being bounced around. Some of them aren't so good. Some of them involve, FDA regulation. Some of them involve regulating cannabis like tobacco, things that I think are something that our industry should be very concerned about. But I assure the listeners that NCIA is always looking out for our members and the industry broadly, and we are developing policy recommendations that will lift all boats, in a sense, the large businesses as well as the mom and pops. So if you're listening and you are at all involved in the business of cannabis, please do visit our website, thecannabisindustry.org. Become a member today. This pandemic has, we talked about the events earlier, that has cost NCI significant revenue. We have downsized just like so many other businesses here, across the country. But we have not downsized our government relations, operation. We are continuing, to advocate every single day, even though we can't sit in Congress in person. We're on the phone. In Zoom meetings, constantly making sure that the industry's voice is heard. And the more members we have, the louder that voice gets. So again, it's thecannabisindustry.org, or give us a call, anybody be happy to help plug your business into the association. Thanks again, you guys. This has been a great conversation.
Well, thank you so much for being on, Aaron. And there's a lot of new people moving from other states to Michigan. That are from other states in the industry and are listening, and then these new people that weren't part of getting Michigan legalized What an opportunity now to go out and be a part of the federal process. If you missed it in Michigan, or if you did, you can help out federally. We need the help. And then if you're an employee at a company and you want to stand out, like, look into the NCIA, you know, talk to them, start lobbying and working. And, you know, as business owners that I know, if they saw an employee doing that, that would be very impressive. So with that, we'll see everybody next week. Thanks.
Thanks, you guys.
The Smoke and Rope Podcast is produced and hosted by me, Ryan Basor, the owner of Redemption Cannabis. Have ideas for episode topics or would like to be a guest on the show? Contact us at ryanb@redemptioncanna.com. Thanks for being along for the journey.